Good morning, board members, Lahontan staff, and the public. Welcome to the regular meeting of the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board. My name is Rob Pierce, and I am the acting chair. The former chair, Ezra Mustavavi, has resigned from the board. We thank Ezra for her years of service to the board and wish her the best with her endeavors. Today's board meeting is being conducted in person from the South Lake Tahoe and via Zoom. AGP Video is hosting our board meeting. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board here today. Amy Horn from Truckee. Hello. Rick Deaver from Crestline.
Good morning.
And Jeff Lux from Truckee.
Good morning.
Kimberly Cox from Hellendale is unable to join us today. Our executive board staff are here today in South Lake Tahoe, including our executive officer, Ben Letton, our legal counsel, Elizabeth Barrett, board clerk, Ariel LaFarga, and our assistant board clerk, Jasmine Enerson. We'll also be joined by other staff members for individual agenda items. For those who are present and wish to speak on an agenda item, please fill out the orange card in the back of the room and hand the card to Jasmine Enerson. In addition, we are receiving presentations and public comment through Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment via Zoom, you should have submitted a virtual speaker card to our board clerk, Ariel LaFarga, and be in the Zoom meeting room. If you think you might be interested in commenting via Zoom, please contact our board clerk promptly at ariellafarga@waterboards.ca.gov. For those joining us via Zoom, your camera will be turned off and you will be muted until it is your turn to speak. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute again. This meeting is being webcast and recorded, so please speak clearly. With that, we go to our first item, public forum. Any persons may address the Water Board regarding a matter within the Water Board's jurisdiction that is not related to an item on this meeting agenda or currently pending before the Water Board. Do we have any speakers for the public forum? We have none. So let's go on to the next item. The Water Board will consider adopting minutes of the regular meeting of the July 9th, 2025. Did everybody get a chance to look at that? Are there any motions?
I move we adopt the minutes of the prior meeting.
Second.
And we'll have a vote. Jeff?
Aye.
I vote aye. Rick?
Aye.
And Amy?
Aye.
The minutes pass. Let's go on to the next item. Water Board's members will provide updates to the Water Board and the public on events and activities of interest. Do we have any board members who wish to? Nothing from you, Jeff? Rick?
Nothing.
Amy?
I have nothing.
And I have nothing as well.
Acting Board Chair.
Yes.
I was expecting Nicole Morgan from State Board.
Okay.
For this item, I do not see her in the room, and I don't see her on the Zoom platform. Board Clerk Ariel, have you heard from Nicole? Do we know what her schedule or plans are?
I have not. I will reach out to her assistant.
Oh, there she is right now. Just walked in. Ears were burning.
It's your turn.
You can just walk right up to the podium.
Well, good morning. Seems that I arrived just in time. Quite a few things going on at the State Water Board, as always. And so our attendant use plans, those we do for both our clean water and our drinking water programs, that lays out how the State Water Board is going to administer its funding programs for both drinking water and for wastewater over the next state fiscal year. So our clean water attendant use plan was adopted by the State Water Board on August 5th. And then on August 19th, we adopted the drinking water state revolving funds attendant use plan. So Delta Conveyance, this is something that I can not really speak about, but wanted to nevertheless give you just a quick little update. On June 20th, our administering hearing officer releases the sixth amended hearing notice for the Delta Conveyance Project hearings. The evidentiary portion of the public hearing resumed on August 12th and will be coming through and will continue through August. We only have a couple more days left. August has gone by very quickly. It will also go through September and October via Zoom. Additional information can be found on the project website. So, water measurement and reporting regulation, SB 88. On August 5th, the State Water Board adopted revisions to the diversion measurement and reporting regulation. So, additional information also can be found on our website regarding those revisions. Let's see here. So, our fees. So every year, the State Water Board staff do take a look at the fees. We are primarily a fee-based organization. And so they take a look at those fees, and they start working with our stakeholders around springtime. They have additional meetings. Those meetings have concluded. And so now our staff have recommended fees for these, I'm going to say fee adjustments for this coming fiscal year, and so they'll be bringing those for consideration by the State Water Board on September 16th. So there's a few days left. If you know of anyone who, or if you are interested in applying to be a member of our SAFER Advisory Group, applications are open for the Safe and Affordable Funding for Equity and Resilience Advisory Group. So it is to fill 10 seats for the 2026-2027 term. The advisory group is made up of 20 appointed members that represent public water systems, technical assistance providers, local agencies, non-governmental organizations, the public, and residents served by community water systems and disadvantaged communities, state small water systems, and domestic wells. And so that is open till the 31st, and so just a couple more days left to submit an application. And so just wanted to admit just to provide you an update on our tribal affairs program. On July 31st and August 1st, the water boards co-hosted the 2025 Tribal GIS Summit with the California Tribal Geographic Information Systems, aimed at advancing indigenous geospatial capacity, data sovereignty, and environmental stewardship. Key themes include indigenous data sovereignty, environmental monitoring, climate resilience, and interagency collaboration. Last but not least, Sacramento River Temperature Management Plan on June 24th, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation submitted the Sacramento River Temperature Management Plan, also known as a TMP, to the State Water Board for approval pursuant to the Board Order 90-5. The TMP describes how Reclamation will operate its facilities to meet temperature requirements for the preservation of salmon that spawn and live below Shasta Reservoir. The Board Executive Director Eric Oppenheimer issued a conditional approval of the TMP on July 3rd, and additional information is available on the water rights web pages on the State Board's website. So with that concludes my report for this board meeting. I am available now for any questions, and always you can reach out in between board meetings for any questions.
Do board members have any questions?
I don't. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. It's great to see you in person.
Thank you so much.
Twice in 1 year.
Oops. Next, we will turn to item 4, update on the results of the Tahoe Keys Lagoons Aquatic Weed Control Methods Test. Staff, can you please bring your presentation? Timothy Middlemas Clark will start out.
There we go. All right. Good morning, Acting Chair Pierce and fellow board members. My name is TJ Middlemas Clark, and Supervising Water Resource Control Engineer and the lead for your Regulatory and Cleanup Division. I will be joined by two guest speakers today, Dennis DeBeglo from the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, also known as TRPA, and Dr. Lars Anderson on behalf of the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association, TKPOA. Additionally, Peter Grant, Vice President for TKPOA, will be introducing Lars when his slides begin. Let's see, next slide, please. This presentation contains an update on how the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association controlled methods tests went. You will hear the terms TKPOA CMT and CMT used interchangeably during this presentation to reference this test. Next slide, please. I will be discussing the timeline leading to this point. I will hand off to Dennis after that to discuss the context of the keys within the AIS problems, partnership and purpose of the CMT, and design of the CMT. Then he will hand it off to Lars to discuss findings, the path forward, and potential combinations of treatment methods. Finally, Lars will hand it back off to Dennis to close with the soundness of the findings, next steps, and the tour preview. Next slide, please. All right, so project timeline. On January 13, 2022, the Water Board adopted resolutions and orders allowing aquatic herbicides to be applied as part of a controlled measures test in the Tahoe Keys. In May 2022, TKPOA applied herbicides to the Tahoe Keys Lagoon and Lake Tillac. Summer 2022 to summer 2024, TKPOA tracked the efficacy of various proposed aquatic invasive species controls and submitted an annual report to the following spring report the following spring of each year. May 13, 2025, the Water Board adopted a resolution rescinding project approvals regarding the TKPOA CMT. June 17, 2025, the Tahoe Science Advisory Council reviewed TKPOA's reports and the final results. And then July 23, 2025, TRPA staff presented an update on the aquatic invasive species program and the TKPOA CMT to the TRPA governing board. Next slide, please. Now I will introduce Dennis. He is the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Manager at TRPA and has helped lead the program since its inception in 2008. He also serves as the co-chair for the Tahoe Partnership Working Group and serves in leadership roles at the regional and national level. You may also recognize Dennis as he presented on AIS at the November 2024 board meeting.
Good morning, members of the board. Thank you, TJ. Members of the public, again, I'm Dennis Abaglu. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Manager for TRPA. TRPA is the designated lead for the federally approved Lake Tahoe Aquatic Invasive Species Management Plan, and we implement that plan through a collaborative approach that TJ mentioned with our basin partnerships that make up the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinating Committee. Next slide, please. As TJ mentioned, I presented to you in November. I just want to take a minute to update you on a couple high-priority items with the golden mussel response. Since 2009, we've had a mandatory inspection program with the golden mussel proximity being just a couple hours away from Lake Tahoe. This season, we implemented mandatory decontaminations as well. Most of our boats have been in a California water body most recently, and so that is a measured response to the infestation that was discovered in the San Joaquin-Sacramento River Delta area. We're also working on updating that management plan I just referenced and incorporating a rapid response tabletop exercise where we would go through if the unthinkable happens with an invasive mussel discovery. Oh, geez. Is it still, yep, a lot of feedback. Is this mic? Yep. Okay. Nope. Testing. That sounds pretty good. Okay. As I mentioned, sorry, we will be doing a tabletop exercise if the unthinkable happens, if an invasive mussel is discovered. So all the entities within the basin that have some level of jurisdiction will be at the table going through a rapid response. And then lastly, permanent inspection stations. We've been prioritizing that since the inception of the program, and we have an opportunity to develop two, one on the Nevada side near Spooner Summit and one on the South Shore in Myers, California. Next slide, please. So we'll talk now about the control methods test, why it's important, and how we got to this point. It is the largest infestation of invasive aquatic plants in the region, and it is the program's highest priority for control. It has a great ability to spread to other areas. It is the main source of other, because of the fragmentation of these plants, spread to other areas of the lake, so it's very important to control this infestation. And aquatic invasives can have devastating impacts to Lake Tahoe's famed clarity, the ecosystem in general, and our $5 billion recreation and tourist-based economy. And we got to this point because of the partnerships and collaboration. We've had a lot of success with the program, and that led to significant investment from the federal government in the form of funding that allowed us to take this next step to addressing the Tahoe Keys. We have a lot of lessons learned within the program that also allowed us to take on something as complicated and complex and large scale as the Keys. And the basin partners understood that this is just not a Tahoe Keys problem, but a lake-wide problem. And starting with the test makes sense. Starting small, like we have with the program, building on those lessons learned, and same with the Keys here with this control methods test. Next slide.
Board Chair, may I ask a question?
Could we wait till the end?
We can.
Okay, go ahead.
Do you know whether these invasive species have spread to the Truckee River through the outlet of Lake Tahoe?
They have. There's been an infestation downstream of the dam for quite some time. There's been some work in the past, but also on the lakeside of the dam, a project was done several years ago to achieve some localized eradication there, but there is still plants from the dam almost to the Alpine Meadows Road area. Sure. So a little bit of background on the Tahoe Keys. It was once part of the largest wetland in the entire Sierras, and it was developed into the residential and commercial some commercial buildings in the 1950s. It consists of three lagoons, the larger homeowner side on the west side, and a smaller lagoon on the east side that also contains that commercial marina, the Tahoe Keys Marina, which is the largest marina in Lake Tahoe. And it's about 1,500 homes with docks, all with access to the lake. In addition to those two lagoons, there's Lake Tilac, which does not have direct access. There is a dam that separates Lake Tilac from the west channel of the Tahoe Keys. And as I mentioned, it is the largest infestation in Lake Tahoe. Next slide. So the species we are talking about with the control methods test, the target invasive weeds, we have two notorious invaders throughout the United States, curleaf pondweed and Eurasian water milfoil. They are in lots of places throughout the United States and treated with various methods, but also we have a native species to California that is acting like a nuisance or invasive species in the Keys called coontail, and we don't really see that anywhere else in Lake Tahoe, but it is a significant part of the biomass. With curleaf pondweed, it develops these hard reproductive bodies called turions, and they could live in the substrate for many, many, many years. And so that's becoming very problematic. And with Eurasian water milfoil, it fragments pretty regularly on its own to spread, but also with boat traffic, those fragments that are churned up by boat props can also promote that spread. So why do we control these overall? As I mentioned, they have severe impacts and the devastating impacts to our economy, but it's also now part of our thresholds. TRPA is charged with achieving and maintaining environmental thresholds, and aquatic invasive species is part of that. So we need to reduce the population significantly to achieve those thresholds. Next slide. So the control methods test in and of itself is an innovative approach to controlling Lake Tahoe's largest aquatic infestation, using science to look at the different treatment methods. It's innovative in the sense that it's using new tools, not only to the basin, but to the AIS world with ultraviolet light. It was a proving grounds here in Lake Tahoe to use ultraviolet light to treat plants, but also the first time use of aquatic herbicides in the Tahoe Basin. But the innovative side of that, no one's ever tried to do this on a one-time basis. So this project implemented a one-time application of aquatic herbicides with mechanical methods, maintaining any knockback that it achieved. And ultimately, the goal of that project is to find long-term solutions for the entire infestation. And TRPA's role in the project is providing the independent oversight with monitoring, certainly bringing the collaborative partnership together to find solutions, and then ultimately, and prior to the implementation, overseeing the environmental analysis and permitting along with Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board. Next slide. A little bit of the funding behind the entirety of the project, not only the implementation, but the planning side of things. As I mentioned, significant federal funding, so with the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency through the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act, but also funding from the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association and also the League to Save Lake Tahoe, really spearheading a lot of the innovative containment side of things. Next slide. So just a brief description of what the control method test is. There was lots of environmental analysis that was necessary, anti-degradation analysis through because of the outstanding national resource water designation. And both this board and the TRBA board did approve the project unanimously. There was, as you're all aware, the legal challenge, but the aspects of the project that were able to continue allowed for the non-chemical methods to move forward. So that first year was the knockback year, using ultraviolet light and aquatic herbicides to achieve significant knockback. And then in years 2 and 3, maintaining that knockback with the mechanical methods that you can see here with bottom barriers and diverse-assisted suction harvesting, along with spot treatments of ultraviolet light. There was also a continuous treatment method called laminar flow aeration. And the kind of the purpose or how that was intended to work is there's these diffusers in the substrate that emit millions of tiny little bubbles, creating this laminar flow, allowing oxygen to stabilize throughout the water column, but also helping degrade some of that substrate where a lot of the nutrients persist and that plants use that for food. Had interesting results, and Dr. Anderson will talk about that momentarily. But the goals of the test were to achieve achieve and maintain a 75% reduction in biomass, and then ultimately finding those methods for long-term control and ultimately improving water quality. Next slide. So TRPA's role, as I mentioned, was providing independent oversight and monitoring. It's a comprehensive monitoring program. That's a little hard to see, but that picture in the upper left, all the little dots represent various multiple monitoring locations, over 100,000 data points, looking at herbicide fate and transport, nutrient levels as a result of die-off of invasive species, and then constant water quality monitoring, and looking at the efficacy. So rake fullness, throwing rakes in an area of infestation and understanding what comes back on that rake. It's a pretty common method for understanding composition, densities, and things like that. And Lars will talk about some of those results. And I think, next slide. This is just the example of the group A treatments. It's various spots having repetition of methodologies with ultraviolet light sites, herbicide sites, and a combination of those sites. Next slide. And this represents years 2 and 3 using those group B methods, multiple methods of the non-chemical nature to maintain any of the knockback that was achieved with the group A methods. Next slide. And so now I'll allow Peter Grant from Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association, the vice president of their board, to introduce Dr. Anderson. Thank you.
Good morning. As Dennis said, my name's Peter Grant. I'm a board member with the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association. I've been a Lake Tahoe resident for 45 years and lived in the Keys for 33 of those years. I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Lars Anderson, who will provide his summary of the CMT, but I just wanted to touch for a minute on the Tahoe Keys Association and our commitment to this process on an ongoing basis. You know, every 2 weeks our group gets in a room together with people from the TRPA and the league and our staff and so forth. There's about 12 of us in a room that they're going through how do we best go at this thing. And so, in fact, we've got a meeting tomorrow morning. But we have been supporting this effort since 2014 now. We just recently passed our most recent funding initiative by special assessment. We've been doing these on an annual basis, but this last time we passed a four-year funding going forward from now into the next 4 years. So we remain very committed to this process. So we know how important it is. So to Dr. Anderson, Lars has spent his entire career in the field of aquatic invasive plants, master's in biology from San Diego State, PhD in aquatic plant and cell biology from UC Santa Barbara. From 1980 to 2012, he was the research leader for UC Davis Aquatic Invasive Weeds Laboratory. Kind of interestingly, in 1995, when this whole weeds thing started popping up, our association reached out to Dr. Anderson when he was at UC Davis, and he actually, his laboratory did quite a bit of research and investigative work that actually resulted in a letter to Lahontan, the director at the time, Dr. Harold Singer, 30 years ago. So this is something that's been on our radar for a long time. Lars retired in 2012, and in 2014, we were fortunate to hire him as a consultant. For 11 years, the Keys and the whole process have benefited enormously from Lars being on our team. And as a self-professed high school college science geek, I love his passion and I love his absolute fixation on the science of all of this. So anyway, Dr. Lars, thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning, board, and thanks very much for the opportunity to give you a brief update on the results on the CMT. As Peter said, I've been involved with the Tahoe problem up here since 95. We did some of the first surveys around Lake Tahoe at that time. And I must say, I never thought I'd be in front of the board in 2025 still talking about this. But here we are. So we have the first slide. And I want to remind you, this is a collaborative process we went through. This is the group that was so smiling so much because that was the first day of the CMT, and you may recognize some folks from Lahontan, TRPA, the League, and so on, and some more, myself and some other consultants here. The other thing, if you look carefully at this photograph in the background, not the foreground, but the background, you'll notice how low the water level was in 2022 and how much shoreline is exposed. I'm going to get to that. It's kind of It's a running story about CMT and how important it is to understand the changes that go on in the Keys and in the lake over time. Next slide. So I'm going to go right to the results so you'll remember these, hopefully. And if you look at the top arrow, I want to point out that we actually did implement all the planned programs and applications that were intended for the CMT. So that was a major accomplishment. We had 12 teams out here. And at some point, we probably had 100 people over that period doing these projects and the implementation of the methods. The other thing is we did successfully implement all the monitoring requirements from your board and from TRPA. And as Dennis mentioned, this is quite extensive work going on, thousands and thousands of data points, sampling in some cases daily, in some cases weekly, and in some cases every 2 weeks. So very extensive monitoring program for that. But if you look on the top left-hand side, you'll see that our methods show that you cannot use one method in one area. We have a nearshore area, which is fairly shallow, in the mid-channel area that's fairly deep. And we discovered that these methods are not always worked well in those two areas. And just as a kind of a lead into it, we did discover very quickly that the UV method was not very adaptable to the shoreline areas. There's too much structure. It takes too long to work there. You'll see some of those results shortly. But that was one of our first lessons that we learned from there. The other lesson is that our barriers that we put up, the double turbidity curtains, worked quite well. No herbicides and no degradants got into Lake Tahoe proper. So that was successful as part of the project. That was an intended goal and mitigation that we did. If you look at the top, the two right-hand boxes, we actually found that some of our desirable native plants came back into these areas, and particularly some of the areas that were treated with the selective herbicides, we had increase in our desirable native plants. And that was another goal, to increase the population of native plants there. Not always, but in some of those cases, it worked. But lastly, if you look at the bottom right-hand box, it's clear that not one method is going to be the silver bullet for this problem. We have to look at integrating these methods, and I think that's probably the most important outcome of the CMT, is that we need to look at all these methods and apply them carefully in an integrated fashion so we have the optimal control of the system. So let's go right into the next slide, please. And as Dennis mentioned, we did a lot of monitoring, and I'm not going to go into the details of those too much, but these are the three main areas where we monitored. We did look at water quality, typical standard water quality, DO, pH, and so on throughout the system. Of course, looked at very much carefully at the residues of herbicides and the degradants after they were applied. And, of course, those are all in the first year's report to the water board. And then the other two that methods are showing up there are the hydroacoustic scan methods. This is a way of looking at the broader impacts of the plants in the system. And it's basically a sonar device that tells you how much of the plants are out there, and you can do these every 2 weeks, is which we've been doing. The disadvantage of this scan system is it doesn't tell you what species are out there. And for a program like this, we really need to know what species are being responding to each of the treatments that we did. So for that reason, the bottom one, the rake sampling that Dennis mentioned, that's the critical one, because that tells us what species are on every rake sample we took, what proportion of the species are on that sample. And interestingly enough, we also were able to get some numbers of turion that were produced on an acreage basis from this, as well as our diver removal method. So these methods really provide the most of the information. Mostly what I'll talk about today is efficacy, and most of that's derived from the rake samples because it's our most detailed efficacy metrics that we can get from it. Next slide. So I want to talk about the conditions very briefly because they did change over that three-year period. This is a typical site of high water conditions in the Keys last year. You'll notice there's very little shoreline that's not covered with water. And if you look at the angles of the docks, you can tell that the water is quite high. So I've inserted a picture of the 2022 application period in the next slide. And you'll notice, next slide, please. So you'll notice I bracketed the exposed shoreline in 2022 just to reemphasize the fact that we had a large portion of that shoreline that was never given any treatments at all in 2022. And this is really important because some of our treatments were called combination treatments, where we treated the shoreline with a herbicide and did the UV system down the middle of those channels. So the implications for this are pretty important. The next slide kind of brings this right to the fore. So I've just showed the three levels here. They aren't exactly to scale because the biggest change occurred between 2022 and 2023. But if you look at the bottom level, that's when we did our first treatments in 2022. And some of those whole site treatments were herbicides applied to the entire volume. And the next slide just shows a grid of that. Next slide. Thank you. So that would be representing the whole treatment sites for 2022. But you'll notice in the next 2 years after that, there's additional habitat that's now submersed. So these plants now had a place to go that they didn't have before. And this begins to affect how efficacious those treatments are, both in the shorelines and in the total volume. The next slide, the next clip, thank you. So this is even more important if you look at those nearshore treatment areas with the combination treatments. You can see that in year one, which is 2022, we had nice shoreline treatments, but by the time we're into year two and three, those areas are underwater, and now we have additional habitat in the shoreline that is available for the plants to move into. I want to stop at this point because the The importance of this really is quite significant. Dennis mentioned the three species that we have. Cootail has no roots, so it is one of the most mobile plants out there in the system. In the wind movement, boat movement, incoming water during the seasonal changes in water levels causes that plant to move around. People do. Animals move it around. So when those new habitats were available in 2023 and 2024, we found that coontail moved into those areas as well as the deep water areas as well. The other thing is with curly-leaf pondweed, because these turions that Dennis mentioned are formed, they become a very, very effective dispersal agent. So we're finding that as we looked at this in the next 2 years, from the first year, we had movement of both coontail and curly-leaf pondweed into these areas that now were underwater and they weren't before. So you can see how this affected the efficacy of our treatments out there. So next slide. So our goal was to reduce the overall abundance by 75%. That's the threshold that TRPA has for the long-term goals of managing the invasive aquatic plants. So I'm going to show you some of the data from that. Some of it's based on it's all based on the rake data. Some of these are color-coded maps, and others are arrows that we've used to show the different species responses. So the next slide is a map. So this is the summary of the Group A methods, and that was the herbicide treatments, for example. And everything that's got a green star means we have 75% control. We were successful over that three-year period. So this is the summation of the 3 years. You'll notice the lower right-hand side is Lake Tillac. We had one good year of treatment there, and then we lost control of that in years 2 and 3. And primarily that's due to the coontail moving into that site that was treated at that time. But you can see we had some pretty good control of most of the sites and some moderate control in others. Next slide. So I'm not sure how well you can see this. I think this screen is better here. But what we wanted to do was to show how these plants responded individually to these treatments. So we use these arrows. The darkest shaded arrows, parts of the arrows mean that's 75% control or better. The moderate shaded one is a moderate control. Then the open ones means we really didn't have sufficient control in those sites. If you look at the upper pair of arrows, those represent the responses of your raisin and water milfoil. And you can see we got really good control all the way up through year 3 pretty much with our endothal treatments. But if you look at the nearshore area, you see we lost some control in year 3 coming into that as well. Then moving down to the middle two arrows, that's curly-leaf pondweed. And you see we did not have as good as control with that with endothal except for the first 2 years. So we lost control in the third year with this, primarily because that plant moved into these areas that had not been submersed before and treated before. And then if you look at coontail, again, the same problem. We had pretty good control with the midwater areas in the first 2 years, but we lost it in the third year. So this is primarily due to this change in water levels affecting the habitats in those systems. Next slide. Looking at triclopyr, this is where it really gets interesting. Triclopyr is a very selective herbicide that controls dicotyledonous plants primarily. And we knew it would not control coontail. And you can see it didn't by looking at the bottom two arrows in there. But you can see we had excellent control for 3 years of Eurasian water milfoil. And you may ask yourself, why did we use this one when we also had endothal? It turns out triclopyr actually moves from the shoots into the roots and rhizomes, so it's translocated and has a longer-term effect on these plants. And we saw that with 3 years in the mid-channels. We almost got 3 years in the nearshore with this one as well. But the real surprise in this graph, and you may not realize that, is that we controlled curly-leaf pondweed with triclopyr. And I say it's a surprise because it's not even on the label as a target species for that herbicide. So this is kind of a new finding. It's not unusual for some of the monocot plants to be affected by these growth regulators. If you've ever heard of water hyacinth, that's another one that is surprisingly affected by triclopyr. But this is really interesting information because we got long-term control in the mid-channels with triclopyr for curly-leaf pondweed. But you can see in the near shore, again, we really lost control in that second and third year with that, again, due to the change in habitat over that time. And, of course, no control with coontail. Next slide. So looking at the Group A combination sites, again, just to remind you, these were sites in which in the first year, only the nearshore areas were treated. And then subsequently, the UV light was used in the middle sections of those sites. So this shows that we had some control and some mixed results and some no control at all in these sites. And it was quite variable, I think partly because we couldn't start the UV treatments until the second year in these combination treatments. So we went through a year of treatment with the site, with the near shore only with herbicides, and then the next year we started the UV down the center of those sites because the curtains were in place. But we still had some pretty good success. I think the reason we have the red the uncontrolled areas, again, is the habitat change primarily in there in those sites. Next slide. So looking at the UV only, again, this is an important one because this is we had a lot of hopes for this, and it does look pretty promising in some areas. This is where these three sites that you're looking at were treated with UV from years 1, 2, and 3, with the exception of one site was skipped in year 2. But this is the results of the overall three-year. And if you look at this, you don't quite get the right story behind it because the next slide shows looking at the last 2 years only. One more click on this slide. So if you look at years 2 and 3 only, you can see we actually had much better control. And this is because this is a developing technology. And the UV system was improved by increasing the exposure duration in the second and third year, by increasing the overlap of the UV array of lights, and by repeating it more often in the second and third years than in the first year. So it's a learning process. And you can see if you just look at the last 2 years, it looks pretty good. We had good control of those, except when you look at that drawing again, that perimeter red zone is the near shore zone that was not treated because that UV light is not applicable for that those near shore areas. There's too much structure in the way. It takes too much time to get in there, and you can't do it. Next slide. So this is LFA, and there's been a lot of discussion about LFA, about its effect on the aquatic ecosystems, about aquatic plants in general, and what you're looking at is the results of actually more than 3 years of use of LFA in the Tahoe Keys, and the answer is it does not control aquatic plants. It's very simple. It doesn't work. It does have an effect on the water column mixture, and you can get DO more evenly distributed vertically. You get temperature distributed more vertically, but it had no impact on reducing aquatic invasive plants. In fact, in some of the LFA sites, we had more biomass than we had in our control sites, and it may be that we've just generated a better system for those plants to do well in. But it doesn't control aquatic plants, and that's the end of that story. This is over 3 years of looking at this approach. Next slide. So just to summarize it again, looking at all those sites for Group A, you can see where the green stars come out. For the most part, successful. That red number 3 in the middle is LFA. TELAC didn't look so good except for our first year in there. So we've got some real variable responses to these treatments in there. But a lot of them were really successful for these Group A methods. Okay, next slide. So just in summary, the herbicides brought 60 to 75% control in the mid-channel areas. Triclopyr was the big surprise. We got control of curly-leaf pondweed in the mid-channel areas and a lot of the near shorelines as well. The combination sites looked pretty good, but we had a lot of variability, I think partly because of that change in the water level and the change in the habitat that was not treated. UV only was successful where it was done in the last 2 years, but the UV is really not, at least at the stage it is now in development, it is not appropriately used and cannot be used successfully in the near shore areas because it's too difficult to get in those, it's shallow, there's too many structures for it to work in there. And then the second to last bullet, I already mentioned the high water, that really did affect our efficacy for these treatments. And then last point with the LFA, and again, no reduction in AFP, but it did have some improvement in water quality within those sites. Okay, moving on to the Group B methods. So this will be really quick, and Dennis covered these. This is the spot UV spot treatments. And again, we had pretty good success on these. The bottom line is the larger they were, the better they were controlled. And again, these were central parts of the system. These were the middle channels, not the near shore. Because again, the UV system works best when it's in open area like this. So most of these look pretty good. Either they had really good success or we had moderate success with the UV treatments. And this required 3 repeats in those areas, at least 3 to 4 repeats in treatments. Next slide. These are the bottom barriers. And actually, once they're in place, they're almost 100% effective because they block all the plant light, they block all the gas exchange, but they're not selective, and that means that they're going to kill the native plants underneath those bottom barriers as well. And the other thing we discovered is when those barriers were removed in the fall, we had some regrowth from turions from curly-leaf pondweed, and some of the other plants. And we actually did some treatments after, and some of these were removed to see if we could affect those plants that are coming back. And there's some success with that. But it points out the need to do some follow-up treatments with these bottom barriers once they come up. Because some of these plants can do really well underneath those barriers, and the treons can last for quite a while, as Dennis pointed out. Next slide. So the last of the group B were the what we call the DASH, or the dyer-assisted suction removal. And I should point out, of all the methods that you've been listening to and hearing about, this is the only one that actually removes entire plants as part of the process. So the dyers actually remove the plants, pull those plants into a suction device, and bring it up to a screen and screened out. The other advantage of this method is it takes away and removes some of those treons that we've been talking about. And that's also how we got some counts, because we know how many square feet the dyers used to remove these, and we know the numbers. So you can see we had pretty good success in all of these areas. The real disadvantage is it's a very expensive approach to it, also in very small areas. So if you can see the size of our total sites compared to the dyer-assisted removal, it's quite small. But the real advantage is you're actually removing the plants and you're getting rid of some of these propagules that are out there, which is not good. Okay, next slide. So again, summarizing the group B methods, the UV spot treatments really work pretty well as long as they're fairly large. The bottom barriers, while they're in place, are very effective. I think our problem is when you take them up and the fact that they're very small areas, what can you do to stop that regrowth from occurring there? And with the dyer-assisted removal, we had 75% control in most areas, but again, it's a very small area, and we were not being as selective as we wanted to be. When the dyers are removing the plants and bringing them into the suction device, there's some turbidity that gets stirred up, so they don't have as good clarity and visual ability to see what their targets are. So there's some native plants that get pulled up with those as well. And then our post-barrier removal, I mentioned that. We had some success with that, but that was only one treatment. But I think it's an area to look at as to if you're going to do bottom barriers, you have to have a follow-up method for that as well. Next slide. So I want to get back to the growth cycle of curly-leaf pondweed for a minute, because this is a major invasive plant in the Keys, but also in South Shore of Lake Tahoe proper. And this is the life cycle. So you have a spring production of the plant during which it starts making these turions that we've been talking about. And every plant can make dozens of these. And then summer, the turions come off the plant, late summer, and the plant senesces. Those turions get moved around, and then some of them start sprouting again in the fall. So it's unusual. It has an advantage of overwintering as a sprouted plant, and has an advantage of taking off in the spring compared to the native plants that are out there. So the next slide shows you what you have to do. If you want to control this plant, you really have to start working at the two ends of this. Next slide. And so you have to control production, and you have to control the fall germination or sprouting of this plant. And so that's the strategy for controlling curly-leaf pondweed, getting it early enough. And just to emphasize how important those turions are, as I said, we have numbers from the dyer-assisted removals, and we have numbers from our rake samples. And it's pretty astounding. The next slide shows what we found with that. So about 150,000 turions per acre are produced in a season. You start blowing this up to about 50 acres, or about half the size of the West Lagoon, and it's a nightmare. Whether it's 3 million or 7 million, doesn't really matter. You have a huge propagule pressure, and so unless you start making some dense in the production of the turions and in their sprouting, you're never going to catch up and be ahead of this problem. So you really have to work on that. Okay, next slide. So just to recap, again, you've seen this, just to re-emphasize what we found. Some methods work really well in the shallow, nearshore areas. Some methods work well in the deep areas, better. And there's combinations that seem to have a good effect as well. The barriers worked. We had no movement of herbicide or degradants into Lake Tahoe. We had native plants coming back in some areas, especially in the triclopyr areas and endothel areas, because those are very selective herbicides. But again, no one method is going to do the job. You're going to have to look at integrating all these methods together. Next slide. So the implications are, I think, very important. There's three main points. One is we need to continue to incorporate state-of-the-technology methods and methodology, and this might be new methods for UV light. It may be new mechanical methods. It may be new herbicides that have shorter half-lives that are more effective. You really have to keep adding and building on the technology we have to do the best job. We need to prioritize our resources. Right now, we know we really need to focus on curlew pondweed. It's a main problem. You can gather from what I've been telling you that we can actually control Eurasian water milfoil pretty well. We can do that. Curlew pondweed is another problem we have to deal with. Then the last point about all this is that whatever moving forward we do with our long-term program, we need flexibility. We need flexibility from a regulatory standpoint. Every year is going to be a little different. The way the plants respond is different. So you need to have flexibility, and you can't wait a year to get a permit to do it every other year. It's too late. You really have to have built-in flexibility in any kind of a program that goes forward on that. So the last slide is just a summation of the accomplishments we did. Next slide, please. And just to point out that we actually had a fantastic public-private partnership here. We really accomplished a lot in that three-year period. We have so much data now in the Keys, more than anywhere, any other place with that kind of a treatment program. It's huge. And we can build on using that data to develop our methods in the future. And our integrated program was recognized internationally last November with an award. So we had a very serious recognition of the creativity and the uniqueness of our program as well. So I think I'll stop here and hand it back over to Dennis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. Again, Dennis Abaglo, Aquatic Invasive Species Program Manager for TRPA. Next slide, please. One more. I wanted to kind of highlight the oversight that TRPA provided, that independent oversight, by also engaging the Tahoe Science Advisory Council. That is a body of independent scientists that provide scientific guidelines and recommendations to basin decision makers. The Tahoe Science Advisory Council was involved in this project from the planning stages with providing some required peer review during the approval process, but that also review and report back on the annual reports, the three annual reports, and also on the final report that was submitted earlier this year. And as Dr. Anderson mentioned, the comprehensive nature of the data, having really the most amount of information on any weed control project anywhere that's supported by some of the scientists' feedback. That it was a scientifically rigorous and you can read it. It was really good. and the findings are well supported. And a couple quotes in the report is, it's an example of a sound scientifically based applied ecological research program, and the CMT represents the very cutting edge of experimental evaluation of aquatic invasive plant mitigation management strategies conducted in the field. Next slide, please. So next steps, we have lots of information to really dive deep in. That's already happened, as you heard Dr. Anderson, but then really taking that next step and trying to come up with a long-term management plan. So we're having meetings tomorrow, as Mr. Grant mentioned, but also some work to maintain some of the benefit that was achieved in over the CMT with some work in 2025, this occurring now, with ultraviolet light, hitting some of those curly leaf pondweed hotspots, and you'll get to see an example, or you'll get to see the boat, the UV boat today on the field tour. As I mentioned, diving deeper into the analysis of the results, engaging stakeholders that we did in the interim or in the early process with the planning of the CMT, but bringing in additional stakeholders with adjacent property owners such as the U.S. Forest Service, but also because of the east side of the lagoon with the Tahoe Keys Marina, they're a significant owner as well, and so bringing them to the table. And after some workshops that we're planning over the course of the fall, having a science symposium looking at all of the pieces of information, diving deeper into some of the questions that have been raised over the term of the CMT by the public and by the project partnership, and that is scheduled for early 2026. And then ultimately developing that long-term management plan. It's got to be feasible. We got to understand costs, the regulatory boundaries that we have, and also conducting another environmental analysis for the whole enchilada, if you will. And then along the way, we can keep this board engaged for feedback and updates as you require. Next slide. So just a quick overview of the field tour today. From here, we'll be going to that Green Star. It's on Garmisch Street. We have some handouts as far as where that location is. You can put it in Google Maps to find it. But there's a boat ramp there that TKPOA uses for harvesting. It's not open to the public. And that's where the UV boat will be. And we can engage with the developer of that technology. And there will also be some harvesting in that location as well. You can see that is the maintenance approach Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association uses to maintain some of the beneficial uses with recreation and navigation. And then the laminar flow aeration, Dr. Anderson mentioned, that is that yellow star. We can see that happening. And I believe that's it, if there's any questions for the group. Next slide. Is that it? Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. We have one public comment. I think we'll go with that first, and then we'll come back for questions. So is Laura Patton here? And introduce yourself and who you represent when you come up. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Pierce, members of the board. My name is Laura Patton. I'm the Natural Resource Director at the League to Save Lake Tahoe, also known as Keep Tahoe Blue. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. You know, I'd also like to thank TRPA and Dr. Anderson for their presentations as well. The League strongly supports the Tahoe Keys Control Methods Test, our partners, and its conclusions. The Control Methods Test really confirmed what we long expected. The weeds in the Tahoe Keys are the single greatest ecological threat to Lake Tahoe. They degrade water quality, harm habitat, and they also create a pathway for invasive species to spread throughout the lake. The results also revealed an alarming trend that Dr. Anderson mentioned, which is that curly leaf pondweed is exploding in the Keys and then out into the lake proper as well. So really, if left unchecked, it's going to accelerate the spread of invasive weeds and really put the whole lake at risk. The controlled methods test clearly showed that no single tool is going to solve the problem. A combination of approaches paired with really strong containment is essential to reduce the infestation and keep it from spreading beyond the Keys. Without this containment, which the League has supported financially over the last few years with our partners, decades of that control work around the lake are really at risk of being undone. The project provided the science, the scientific review through the Tahoe Science Advisory Council, proof of concept, and, you know, kind of showed the partnerships that we need to really address this urgent threat. Now we need to act with that urgency to build on the control methods test, create a comprehensive long-term management plan to contain and control the infestation, really before it spreads beyond our ability to manage it. The League really urges the board to continue to support these next steps, and I'll just say together we can keep Tahoe blue. So thank you.
Thank you so much. So now we'll go to board questions. Jeff, do you have some?
I do, and I think they're for Dr. Anderson, if you maybe might come up. Thank you. Just five quick questions. First, I just want to thank everybody involved in this. I'm still a rookie on the group here, and this is really impressive science and just great. Go Aggies.
Yes.
Okay.
I know Jeff from Davis, but back there.
Yeah. I remember you, actually. Yeah. No, UC Davis. I think I'll get more information out in the field, but could you just give us a quick synopsis of how you administer the UV? I mean, do you drop the camera? Does it just flash?
Yeah,
how's it work?
Good question. Yeah, it's an array of UV lights. They're LED lights, so it's very low energy input. And John Paluccio has developed this. He's done a really great job. So it's an array of lights on a grid, and they drop the grid down with hydraulic arms on top of the plants. Then irradiate the plants for, in the first year we were doing it for 3 or 4 minutes, now it's 10 minutes pretty much. And then you move on to the next spot after that, and he overlaps these arrays so he makes sure he's getting control. But that's how it's done. And it's time consuming, and you have to move these around, and you'll see how it works out there. But
yeah.
That's the principle.
Great, thank you. And to follow that up, if there hadn't been the combination knockback in year one, is it your opinion that the UV would have still achieved 75%+? You know, it's making an assumption that the herbicide, you know, may or may not be plausible. We don't know. But how does the UV do, you know, as the first and only, if you will?
Yeah, I think the thing we learned from the UV is that it works in the middle sections pretty well, but you have to start early and have to repeat it 3 to 4 times in that sequence. There's a critical scale, both temporal and spatial, to be successful. If you don't treat things in a large enough scale early enough, you'll never catch up. And my concern about UV, the way, at least the technology we have now, it's fairly slow. And so it's kind of like painting the Golden Gate Bridge, one end you start, the other you got to start again. So where you can do it in a small area, it works pretty well. And I mentioned that the spot UV treatments were very successful when they were large enough. But those were 2,000 square feet, something like that. If you look at the entire, even just the west side of 110 acres or so, it's, you can see how difficult that would be to do in just UV.
Yeah. Well, and my last questions have to kind of follow that on a little bit. So the bottom barrier treatment and the suction treatment, you mentioned, very costly, pretty obvious,
yeah. And
only hitting, you know, fairly small areas.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that if you tried to expand that, even with UV, it would be, are we talking, you know, 10 times as expensive and too small a scale, 100 times,
I wouldn't want to put
40
that number
times?
On
I mean, what's
this
the,
morning?
But. Yeah, no, I know. But I mean, just sort of ballparking.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge
Could you expand it?
Yeah. And then there's the other part, which is the monitoring. And all these methods require some monitoring of some kind that goes with it. But the real critical question is, whatever methods we use, whatever integrated methods we use, has to be done in a large enough scale and early enough to be able to stop that cycle that we've been talking about of crude leaf pondweed. It's not just crude leaf pondweed, but basically that cycle of repeated reproduction, dispersal, reproduction, and so on. And the thing we haven't talked about that much is that when you have this biomass of plants in the keys like this, they're really holding nutrients, and they're cycling from the soil substrate to the plants and then back again, and it just keeps accumulating.
Yeah. Now, last question. Is there a potential for a robotic solution with the bottom barriers and or the suction? I mean, you go out on a golf course, and the little lawnmowers are going all day long, and you know, they
like
go
like a robo suction. Yeah. I
mean, yes.
Well, there's always possibility, but the reality of the keys to is, as I mentioned before, in the inertial area, you've got these structures, piers, posts, and all kinds of things. So you have to deal with that. And then you have to deal with the maintenance and again, the scale, how many of those robotic things you have to have out there to make it work. I know that John has been talking about some remote ways to actually handle his UV treatments. There may be some advantages that can be made that way, but it's not an easy chore. Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
If I can just add a couple aspects to that, to Mr. Lux's questions regarding UV light, when it is the treatment is applied, it's just hitting the plant that is above the surface. It's not addressing the roots, and so it needs repeated treatments, a long, slow death, if you will, to injure it continually over time before the roots ultimately die out. So it's not that these plants are dead necessarily. We'll learn more as we continue monitoring this year and with the additional UV light work that's happening as we speak. So we'll continue to learn how long it might take to actually kill the plant. And then as far as costs, that is something that is being addressed this fall. There'll be a straw proposal by the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association for the partnership to react to, and part of that straw proposal for a long-term management plan will include potential costs of the various applications and monitoring needed. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick, do you have questions?
Yeah, I got a couple. Of course, this is for Dr. Anderson. I'm sorry. How did you decide on the areas to test in the Keys?
Yeah, really good question. So we had a lot of discussion on being able to have replication of our treatments. We didn't want to just use one large area and not replicate it. So that was the decision point. And then because of the ability to monitor where the plants were, we tried to pick the plants where we had the similar distribution of these species in the different areas. The other big decision point was after the first year, where we did the knockback in the first year, We looked at the rake sampling following that and tried to figure out where the hot spots, where the ones that actually had achieved the 75% knockback, and let's go into those with our Group B treatments. So there was a decision scheme that was used to decide which ones were put them, and they were delineated on maps and the polygons created, and that's how those maps were generated for that.
Yeah, that makes total sense. My second question, the nearshore UV, is the problem the docks are in the way? Is that...
That's part of the problem. The other thing is the shallowness of it. And one of the issues, and John may talk about this afternoon in the field trip, if he has those lights too close to the ground too often, they start getting, blocked up with some materials from the bottom. He's had some problems with that. So I think it's a combination of shallowness and basically structures and getting around there.
So they get scale on the UV lights? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there's scale on the lights. But and keep in mind, here's the other thing that it's hard to tell unless you start looking at the aerials by season. If you go out there in early May, it looks pretty good. But by the time you're into the 4th of July, you've got docks filled with boats. And now you've got a UV method skirting around these docks and trying to get control. So it's a combination of the structures that are there all the time and then the boats that come in when they launch in the spring. And that period. So you've got a combination of structures out there to deal with.
All right. Well, thank you. Very well presented.
Thank you. Amy, you have questions?
Yes. I remember when we approved this test, I was very impressed with how the complexity of the study, how well thought out it was, all the repetition and the design. I mean, that's a very difficult thing to work out and so that you have reliable results, statistically significant reliable results at the end of the whole thing. So congratulations on your award for this test. And I do have one question for Dr. Anderson. Which is, to your knowledge, in California, are endothal and triclopyr used in reservoirs supplying municipal or drinking water supplies?
Yeah, they are. There are drinking water requirements and distances from intakes from drinking water that are required, but they are used there. They are.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you. I have no questions, but I really appreciate the information. I think we're going to take a 15-minute break right now, if that's all right with everybody. I need one.
Yeah, I agree. I there's a lot of people in the audience here, so at some point, either after the break or before, maybe we ask if there's anyone else who wants to, you know, say a few words on this item.
Okay. Can we make it 10 minutes? We can make it 10 minutes. All right, we'll be back at 20 after then.
Dream on.
I will dream on.
It'll happen. Okay, we're ready to get back to it here. Our next item is, item 5, and we'll be talking about racial equity resolution. 1-year update, and staff, can you please begin your presentation?
Good morning.
It says it's on.
It's on.
There it goes.
Oh, can you hear me now? All right. Morning, Acting Board Chair, members of the board, members of the public, and meeting attendees. This is an informational item. On behalf of the Lahontan Region Racial Equity Working Group, my name is Lorianne Sanders, engineering geologist in the Department of Defense and Site Cleanup Program. I'm here with Molina Hov, engineering geologist in the Department of Defense and Site Cleanup Program, and Eli Balderas, environmental scientist in the Planning and Assessment Unit. We will each discuss a few slides to provide a 1-year update since the board's adoption of the Lahontan Region Racial Equity Resolution in August 2024. Although no board action is required, we appreciate feedback and suggestions for future activities. Next slide, please. This presentation includes an overview of the state and Lahontan region racial equity resolutions, a summary of our group activities to date, and plans for upcoming activities. We will have time at the end of the presentation for comments and questions. As an example of a racial equity and environmental justice issue in our region, this is a photo of Mono Lake, located along Highway 395 between Lake Tahoe and Bishop. In the 1940s, water levels in Mono Lake dropped more than 40 feet as water was diverted from the lake. The now famous Tufa Towers were exposed, lake ecology changed, and local tribes' traditions were disrupted. Fast forward to today. A state water board order required an increase in lake levels, and Lahontan Water Board's basin plan was amended to include a definition of tribal beneficial uses. Next slide, please. In 2021, California State Water Board adopted a racial equity resolution, which acknowledged the role racism has played in creating inequities in affordability and access to clean and safe water, committed to advancing racial equity within the State Water Board and the communities it serves, directed its staff to develop a racial equity action plan, and encouraged the 9 regional water quality control boards to adopt similar resolutions. The following year, Lahontan Water Board's executive officer convened a regional staff-led racial equity working group. In 2024, Lahontan Water Board adopted a resolution which affirms the region's commitment to the State Water Board's resolution. Next slide, please. Introducing the current Lahontan Region Racial Equity Working Group. Group participation is open to all staff, and the group changes depending on staff availability. Together, we are committed to ensuring that every Californian in the Lahontan region enjoys equitable protection from environmental harm. We are working toward better understanding the needs of communities within the region, providing equitable access to resources and services, confronting barriers to progress, and incorporating diverse perspectives into programs and policies to ensure that our work addresses environmental injustices and equitably benefits everyone. Eli will walk us through the next few slides. Next slide, please.
Hi. Thank you, Lorian. And good morning, Acting Chair Pierce and members of the board. My name is Eli Balderas. I'm an environmental scientist in our planning and assessment unit and a member of our racial equity working group. I'll be discussing some of the efforts that we have focused on since the board adopted the racial equity resolution back in August of 2024. Those main three areas are education, outreach, and drafting of a racial equity and environmental justice action plan. We'll discuss these activities in more detail on the next few slides. Next slide, please. So first, I'd like to mention that we updated our racial equity and environmental justice webpage on the Lahontan website. This new site has a link to our board-adopted resolution, an initial draft of our action plan, as well as useful links and information related to the Lahontan region's ongoing racial equity and environmental justice efforts. As part of our internal education actions, we held a staff workshop in October of 2024 to learn from staff from the Office of Public Engagement, Equity, and Tribal Affairs, or OPETA, to get their perspective on how to develop a racial equity and environmental justice action plan. This workshop also allowed us to gather input from our staff members on things like specific steps that we could include in our action plan. Lastly, myself and another member of our racial equity working group have been participating in the Racial Equity Data Subcommittee, which is a state board-led group. This subcommittee's stated objectives are to build an enhanced staff team and organizational capacity, to regularly use and implement an equity lens in data-intensive work, and to establish a shared working space for water board staff across the state to work on equity-centered data projects. Participation in this group has facilitated our racial equity working group's outreach efforts through providing training and guidance and in the development of a Lahontan region-specific mapping tool that I'll show in the next slide. Next slide, please. So first, I'd like to mention that this map was developed by one of our newest staff members, Jacqueline Royer, so thank you, Jacqueline. It uses CalEnviroScreen data, but considers only the census tracts that overlap or fall within the Lahontan region, which is outlined in black, to assess socioeconomic and environmental factors. Based on all of these variables, we were able to calculate a region-specific index that shows us specific communities in areas where outreach should be prioritized due to exposure to water quality threats and lack of resources. The communities of greatest concern are highlighted in dark red, and the lowest concern communities are off-white in color. Next slide, please. And while the Lahontan region conducts outreach to all communities throughout our region, there is a need to conduct focused outreach in key communities, which again are highlighted in red, that have limited access to transportation, face language barriers, and at the same time are burdened by poor water quality. Focused outreach involves approaches that promote meaningful engagement, which may mean taking additional measures such as translating documents, using plain language in those documents, using flyers, and participating in community events to discuss the role of the Water Board and gather input for the Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Action Plan. The development of the action plan is just the first step in improving our communication with these communities. Next slide, please. And this brings us to outreach, which is a key area that the Racial Equity Working Group has been working on over the past year as we've been developing our action plan. As part of our outreach, we first sent initial interest letters to tribal communities in our region via email or mail in accordance with those tribes' stated preferences. And to date, we've received 4 responses. Our tribal coordinator also followed up with several tribes via phone calls to really ensure that we're making our best effort to communicate our interest in their feedback. In July of this year, we also sent an email and survey out to subscribers on our Racial Equity and Environmental Justice mailing list to gauge the interest of individuals in participating in the development of our action plan. Unfortunately, we did not receive any responses to that survey. However, with plans to distribute flyers and send our initial draft action plan to several more mailing lists in our region and statewide, we hope to cast a much wider net and reach more interested parties. We're also engaging with OPEDA to get connected with community leaders and receive guidance on in-person outreach events, where we hope to talk face-to-face with individuals in prioritized communities and hopefully spark more interest in this important effort. Next slide, please. And with that, I'll pass it off to Melina Hov to wrap up our presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Eli. Hi, my name is Melina Hov. I am an engineering geologist in the Department of Defense and Site Cleanup Unit, and today I'm going to be presenting on the initial draft Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Action Plan. The Racial Equity Working Group started developing the draft action plan in fall 2024. Initial development of the action plan incorporated input from staff gathered during an all-staff brainstorming session, as well as referencing other regional board and state action plans. The action plan outlines our region-specific commitments to incorporating racial equity in our water quality decisions and regulatory actions. The current draft outlines specific commitments to workforce diversity, racial equity training and awareness, community engagement, and water quality protection. Some examples of our specific actions include developing outreach strategies to engage with underrepresented and disadvantaged communities, and commitments to ongoing staff and board member training opportunities on various racial equity and environmental justice topics. Next slide, please. The initial draft Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Action Plan has been posted on the Lahontan Water Board webpage for public comment as of this week, offered in both English and Spanish. The public comment period will continue for at least 90 days. We plan on sending a link to review the action plan to our existing contact lists and state board contact lists. As Eli mentioned earlier, some of our outreach efforts will also include outreach events and flyer distribution to gather public feedback on the initial draft action plan. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Oh, there you go. Perfect. Thank you. For those who are interested, please scan the QR code to take you to our Lahontan Water Board Racial Equity and Environmental Justice webpage. Our webpage includes updates on our latest efforts for the racial equity work. This webpage also includes the initial draft action plan, which is around 10 pages long, available for public review and comment. The Racial Equity Working Group plans on accepting comments via online survey form, email, mail, and in person. Further details on how to comment on the initial draft action plan is available on our webpage. As our work on the action plan progresses, updates will be provided to the board. Next slide, please. And here we have a timeline that outlines our major goals for the next year. We are currently in our 90-day review period for the initial draft action plan, and during this initial draft review period, the Racial Equity Working Group plans on conducting community outreach to receive additional feedback on the document via in-person events and flyer distribution. After this review period, the Racial Equity Working Group will work to resolve and edit the initial draft action plan based on public feedback and any feedback received via community outreach. After revising the initial draft action plan, we'll issue a final draft for another public review period. And after that round of revisions, we plan on presenting the final Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Action Plan to the board in August 2026. Next slide, please. Thank you for your time. We also have the QR code here again for our Racial Equity and Environmental Justice webpage where you can access the initial draft action plan. Now I'd like to pass it back to Acting Board Chair Pierce for any board member comments or questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have one public comment we'll take first, and that's Marty Meaden, is it? And just state your name and your affiliation when you come up.
Good morning. Hangamahese, howdoogie, and buenos dias. My name is Marty Meaden, and I'm here just as an individual of with interest. I do want to acknowledge that we are visiting Washoe traditional homeland of Lake Tahoe, and I really do appreciate what your group is doing to ensure the survival and stability of the lake and the other resources within the regional areas that you serve. The Numu, the Washish, the Niwi are all the original Americans of the Lahontan Water District area. I'm calling it district, okay? Our history should be included in the action plan to reiterate the importance of water to sustain our culture, our cultures. The action of the Dakota people against the Dakota Access Pipeline is evidence that we as natives continue to use and see water as being sacred. Please help to develop the Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Action Plan, because to destroy the land is to silence the ancestors, to poison the water is to poison ourselves. And what happens to Earth happens to all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rick, do you have questions? Board question? Whoops, sorry.
Let's go ahead, Rick.
No questions.
Jeff?
Is that all the public?
Yes.
There's no one else? Okay, thank you. Not so much questions. I appreciate the work. It's super important. Appreciate your comments. Awesome. I did have a couple just suggestions, and I think you've already you touched on them, and I suspect if I dug deeper, so it's more or less suggestions. I have a little bit of background in community engagement. They used to pay me to do it. I don't know why. A couple of thoughts. One is I think the personal contact approach is critical in this case. So those phone calls, you know, if you've done 5, do 50. Send the letter again. And, both for tribes and also, you know, organized groups that you can identify. It sounds like you're doing that, but that's really critical because it's such a big region for one. So that's really, really good. I'm glad you're doing it. I would push that. I think the fact that you're prioritizing or setting priorities based on EnviroScreen risks is also good, because I think you really, you know, there's some pretty significant differences across the region, and it sounds like that's happening. I think that's great. And the other thing, you mentioned it, and again, I would push this very, very much if you can do it. I know staff resources are always stretched, but going to existing established events is really the way to go here, as opposed to sort of holding a, because when you hold a meeting or an event, particularly when it has a complicated title and it sounds a little arcane, people may bypass it. But if there's, you know, a farmer's market, set up a table somewhere, a community fair that's going on, set up a table. I mean, if to the degree that it's convenient, and it doesn't have to be the expert staff, can be sort of anybody willing. And I would even consider volunteers at that point, because really what you're doing is getting input, and anybody can gather that for you. Social media, I think you're using it. I don't know. There's probably a bunch of rules that say the water boards can't do that, but if you can use social media, go for it. And then I would suggest the last thing is, rather than hold an event about the plan, I would hold an event about water. So if I were doing a broad community event in, you know, pick your place, Victorville or something, I would say, hey, come and learn about water quality and come and, you know, embrace water. So make it broader and then have this be a piece of it. And that does require a little more legwork, because you kind of have to address all questions water. But I think that might give you some advantages in terms of people being interested and wanting to then plug in. And then you can plug in specifically on your draft plan. And then finally, I would suggest, while 90 days sounds like a long time for this kind of work, that's a pretty short one, so you may have to stretch that. Anyway, those are pure suggestions. Take them or leave them, and that's all I got.
Thank you. Amy?
Thank you. First, I agree with Jeff that the comment period should be at least 90 days. Be flexible about that. I was wondering, to whom this question is addressed, but that there were only two responses to the outreach so far and that expressed no interest in participating. Do you see that as a red flag? Who wants to answer that question?
Hi. Okay. Hi, great question. So I don't think we'd consider it a red flag per se. I think with our next phase of outreach that we're planning on doing, we're trying to reach more communities, more organizations, and just trying to expand that initial group of people that we had first reached out to. So with this next planned outreach, we're hoping to get, again, like cast a broader net and then hopefully get more responses and more input.
Okay.
Yeah, because we were working with the limited mailing list that we were working with at first for that initial outreach request.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm just trying to think in what order to do this. I think that Jeff made a lot of really good suggestions that I encourage you to consider. I always worry about, you called out and the blue dots indicated the places where you plan to focus outreach. I always worry about the places in between because of how how data are collected and how the areas are defined. Often small areas in generally rural parts of the state get washed out because the boundaries of the data collection are so huge that the impacts that they might experience. And I know it's a tough thing to deal with, but I always worry about places like Randsburg and Shoshone and Keeler and Walker and on the various other places you drive through as you go up and down the Lahontan area. And I don't know what the solution is, but it's a concern I have. I'd like to ask a question of Mr. Meter, if I may. If I'm saying your name right, I hope. Meaden?
Mr. Meaden. It's an adopted German name from one of the soldiers from Fort Yuma, who married one of my great-great-grandmothers. So I'm Paiute from Mono Lake. Thank you for the picture. and I'm Washoe.
So you would be Numu.
Numu.
Right.
And Washoe from Lake Tahoe, from the northern shore,
okay.
The Loyalton, Sierra Vale area.
Okay.
Currently living in Carson Valley, just down the hill.
Oh, a neighbor.
Yes.
So I'd like to hear your thoughts about whether this is the right time to do outreach, any other thoughts you might have about effective ways to do outreach. I'm concerned that the target audience of the outreach are the same folks who may not want to call attention to themselves these days for various reasons. And if you have any thoughts about that, you know, working through community leaders, people like you first, the personal, you know, phone call outreach kind of approach, what you think might be the best time, the best ways to do the outreach, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Well, tribal entities are notorious for not responding to every and anything until it's a problem. So there are folks within various communities and not just tribal communities that have resources. They know people and they're involved with Sierra Club and Inyo Mountains, Preserve the Inyo Mountains, the Mono Lake Committee and all. We're all connected in some way with some group, and I've offered my contacts to the group, and we'll be contacting James Ramos, who is a friend of mine, to find if we can get some contacts for that he might know of folks that live on the northern slope of the San Bernardino Mountains in the Victorville area and all, to help assist with this. I'm a retired school teacher. I was on the board for the California Teachers Association, so I have a lot of contacts still. And this area was one of my regions that I represented when I was on the board. So I do have some contacts with not just Native folks, but key former leadership people in the various CTA locals along the 395 corridor. So to your original question, is it bad timing? I don't think it's not bad timing. It's just things are happening, things everywhere. I think the turmoil of our country right now, the fires, the lack of some resources and or the diminishing of various resources to some of the tribes, they've kind of insulated themselves now that we need to concentrate on this issue. And yes, water is a big issue, but, you know, right now our priority is sustaining ourselves financially and with what's going on. So I think we can do this. I'm offering to help. And if anyone's driving through Bishop this afternoon, drop off something at the Tri-County Fairs. The fair is happening starting today. And it's American Indian Day, and Sage, who is in charge of it, will get a table, and you guys put your stuff out. I know it's last-minute notice, but it's things, events like that. We're not just targeting Native communities. We're targeting Manny Mo and Jack and Missy and Sissy, so we can get everybody involved, because you never know who you're going to reach. And with just something that's out there, especially in Owens Valley with water. Does that help you, Wendy?
Yeah, thank you very much. I was concerned that we would be getting a very biased sample in response, and you allayed my concerns that there are ways of avoiding that outcome.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for your time, too.
Elizabeth, is it okay if we get a speaker without a card?
I was just going to say, do I need to fill out a card for public comment real quick?
Just come to the podium, and then afterwards, if you could fill out a speaker card, it just helps with our records.
Thank you. Sounds great. Thank you.
first and foremost, I want to recognize the staff members that are putting together the Racial Equity and Environmental Justice Action Plan. I'd like to introduce myself. Manahu Inani Ine Cheyenne Stone, Panatu Nu Agimana, Nu Novido Tovawanamatu. Ihim is from both Washishu and Paiute country. So I recently ended my term as the chairperson for the Big Pine Paiute Tribe here in June 2025. And as a chairperson, I could say we receive tons of information. I would like to commend Jeff for his outreach method. I do recommend going out to the various communities. If you have the budget and travel funds, I would recommend each tribe within the region. It's a huge geographical region that Lahont covers. However, if that's not possible, I would recommend, and I will first and foremost say, come to my homeland in Big Pine, California. I'd be happy to host you guys for your outreach with the tribes. I would reach out to the chairmen personally, the Owens Valley tribes, in addition to one of the Mono tribes. They're currently looking at water negotiations. Water is life, as Marty mentioned. Paiute in the Owens Valley is a tremendous asset, especially that it's governed with a lot of regulations from Lahontan, so it is essential. I would recommend also on your Cal environmental data that you add the federally recognized tribes, in addition to the non-federally recognized tribes, such as the Ksetika tribe at Mono Lake. I think it's just a matter of proposing that the theme is water. Water quality doesn't always ring a bell. The scientific methods and all of that doesn't necessarily sound appealing. Reach out to the chairpersons. I am concerned about the data collection as well. As far as the response, you received none. I did receive emails, but I could tell you it wasn't a priority. Just because we received so many additional items. There are key members in the community. The Bishop Paiute Tribe actually hosts a California Indian Day at the end of September. You are welcome to attend there. A lot of neighboring tribes, as well as the tribal members itself, you could get public outreach. I would also recommend social media for outreach where you have a survey so you don't just get the nation-to-nation response from your tribal governments within the region, but also the people that don't hold a title, because their information is just as valuable. And they, as Marty mentioned, they all have a specific set of skills that they bring, and they might not necessarily hold a title. So I would emphasize tribes in that regard. And as you mentioned, you probably are working with the tribal office in Sacramento or the tribal affairs office. They're a great resource as well, but definitely outreach is a huge need, especially considering that the survey didn't yield any results. I will personally circulate the draft, but again, I think framing it as why is it essential, more important to the water needs, is probably the key. I mean, you say Lahontan Water Quality Board, that's like, oh, great. We only come when we're in trouble or consultation failed in this manner to direct or address the issues. So you need to frame it in a different context. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to go ahead and add, Cheyenne and I have known each other for a long time, and she's put in an application for a board position with Lahontan, which would be cool. The other thing I'd like to add, for contacts with tribes, I don't know if you've worked with the tribal liaisons through NRCS. There's state, regional, and office tribal liaisons, especially in Southern California. They have really phenomenal contacts, and we do a lot of work with tribes on water issues, from irrigation to all kinds of things. So you can just go to the state webpage and look up the staff, and that might be another good resource for you. I appreciate the presentation. So I think we're ready to move on to the next item. And that is Executive Officer's Report. Ben.
All right. Good almost afternoon, but still morning. My name is Ben Letton. I'm Executive Officer for the Lahontan Water Board, and I'll be providing item 6. I do have a slide up here, but I'm going to get to that in a moment. Most of this is just going to be an oral presentation. So first, I'd like to cover personnel changes since the last board meeting in July. Michael Reese, a water resource control engineer for our regulatory enforcement unit, was hired. He started on August 4th, and he comes from Region 1 of the Water Board, the North Coast region. Kristen Shelton, a senior water resource control engineer for our Leviathan Mine unit, was hired, and she comes from Region 5, the Central Valley. So we've done a good job in bringing in folks from other regions recently, and she starts on September 1st. Separations and retirements, acting board chair Pierce mentioned Esra Mustafavi resigned from the board. Appreciate her contributions. She'll be missed. And also Katrina Fleshman, our executive assistant, retired. We acknowledged her her work with the board at the at the July board meeting. And best of luck, Katrina. In terms of vacancies, we have the assistant executive officer vacancy. I'm pretty far along in that recruitment process, and I expect to have an announcement to make hopefully by the end of this week, if not early next week, but not yet. Senior water resource control engineer, a supervisor position is vacant in the in our cannabis program. That'll be a position that's based out of Victorville. I understand interviews are next Friday. Jan Zimmerman is the hiring manager for that. We also have an environmental scientist vacancy also in the cannabis unit, although that position is not yet posted, and a vacancy with a water resource control engineer also for the cannabis unit. So two positions in that unit hasn't been posted yet, but that's soon to come. In terms of the EO report that's in your board packet, I'd like to highlight a few the articles or give a little summary of each one. So starting on bait stamp 6-6, there's an article in there, overview of the underground storage tank UST program by Jeff Brooks. Some key takeaways there are that the statewide UST program aims to protect public health, safety, and the environment from hazardous substance releases. It includes leak prevention, tank tester licensing, cleanup of petroleum releases, and enforcement activities. The Lahontan Water Board Cleanup Site Investigation and Enforcement Unit, also known as CSIE, assists UST operators with cleanup efforts guided by the State Water Resources Control Board Underground Storage Tank Low Threat Closure Policy. Funding for the UST site cleanup and regulatory oversight comes from the UST Cleanup Fund, derived from the motor vehicle fuel tax. This fund helps UST owners meet financial responsibility requirements as and reimbursement eligible cleanup expenses. The Jeff's unit often becomes aware of new cases from referrals coming from the counties. This was one of the ways we find out about these issues. The next is a standing item on the city of Barstow nitrate by Eileen Che. It's on bait stamp 6-7. Some key takeaways here are the city of Barstow is regulated by waste discharge requirements and compliance orders issued by the water board due to historic disposal practices from its wastewater treatment plant. The city is required to monitor and report nitrate effluent and groundwater monitoring wells with specific limits for the nitrogen and nitrate as nitrogen. The Water Board adopted cleanup and abatement order requiring the city to address this nitrate polluted groundwater, but the cleanup is on hold due to commingled plume with perchlorate along Soap Mine Road in the area. The city conducts quarterly sampling of residential wells and provides replacement water if nitrate concentrations exceed certain thresholds. The city has requested modifications to the sampling and replacement water requirements based on recent data. And we plan on revising that CAO within the fiscal year. The next article is just a brief article on annual Hinckley Community Barbecue sponsored by the IRP or the Independent Review Panel. This is by Amanda Lopez. The long of the short is that there was a barbecue that took place on June 7th, 2025 at the Hinkey Community Center. This event was sponsored by Project Navigator and the RRP and was attended by Water Board staff. Approximately 150 community members were present, along with IRP members, Rodel Sanchez, and others. The barbecue prepared by volunteer community members featured things as fun as a bounce house and a raffle. So a lot of turnout. It was a great event. The site cleanup subaccount program, also an article also by Jeff Brooks. This starts on base stamp 6-11. Some takeaways here is that the site cleanup subaccount program, or SCAP, provides grant for projects investigating and remediating water contamination established by the Health and Safety Code in 2014 and overseen by the State Water Board. SCAP-funded projects must meet criteria such as remediating harm to human health and the environment, they lacking other funding sources, and excluding petroleum contamination from leaking underground storage tanks. The program offers funding flexibility with no requested limits, no required cost match, and continuous pre-application process, and an annual appropriation of $34 million from the motor vehicle fuel tax. Current and recent projects in the Lahontan region include investigations of petroleum leaks, chlorinated solvents, and perchlorate contamination, with notable projects like the South Hawaii project at South Lake Tahoe, which received the largest funding award ever distributed by SCAP. And the final article is by Liz Van Diepen. It's titled Sierra Meadow Partnership and Annual Gathering. Water Board staff Liz Van Diepen co-facilitated a breakout session at the Sierra Meadow Partnership Annual Gathering, which promotes communication and collaboration among restoration implementers, academia, and regulatory agency staff. The event included visits to restored meadows and classroom sessions on meadow restoration, meadow research, community engagement, and project planning. The compliance and permitting breakout session discussed tools for restoration permitting and received feedback on issues such as inconsistent requirements, burdensome permitting processes, and the need for permits for minor handwork. Current regulatory environment allows for more flexibility in permit activities within waters of the state and potentially reducing permit burdens for low-threat restoration work. So that last point was actually things that we're doing internally to address some of those permitting concerns that were expressed at the meeting. So let me pause there, Rob, and maybe take questions on any of the articles, and then I've got a few other things to touch on.
Sure. Jeff, do you have a question?
No questions.
Amy? Okay.
Okay, my question is about the nitrate plume in Barstow. In what year did Lahontan start requiring replacement water for the residents of Soap Mine Road?
I'm going to call on Jan Zimmerman if she's available to take a stab at that one. It predated me with Lahontan, but maybe she knows.
Hi, Jan Zimmerman, Division Manager of South Basin. I believe it was 2007, the date of the CAO,
okay,
when replacement water started.
Yeah, thank you. I thought it was when Bob Dodds was still the AEO, so it goes back almost 30 years now. Given that we now in California have the human right to water and we're working so hard on implementing a racial equity and environmental justice program here, I think a couple of the requests from the city of Barstow are non-starters. specifically, increasing the nitrate as nitrogen trigger threshold concentration from 5 milligrams per liter to 10 milligrams per liter, and ceasing supplying uninterrupted water service if 2 years of testing report of nitrate and nitrogen concentrations are below 10 milligrams per liter. I think the secondary standard should be maintained of 5 milligrams per liter. It is the secondary, right? Anyway, that level, the 5 milligrams per liter, should be maintained as the threshold level for those two items. I think that's the only... Yeah, my other comments come later in your report.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. I'd like you to turn your attention to bait stamp 6-21. This is our list of standing items for the year. And I just wanted to note that we have removed one of the standing items, which is the status of grants, because we don't manage many or any grants anymore. I think that standing item was created years ago when there was Prop 84, Prop 50, Prop 40, you know, grant funding. And so we were managing several grants, and it would made sense at the time to provide more regular updates to the board. So for now, we've removed that that standing item from the list. The next thing I wanted to touch on was enforcement. There is no quarterly violations report or unauthorized discharge report in your board packet, but I would like to see if Shelby Barker is available online to provide an update on a couple of settlement agreements.
Good morning. Afternoon. It's now officially 12:03. My name is Shelby Barker, and I am the enforcement coordinator for our region. I just wanted to give a quick update on two new enforcement actions that were finalized since the annual enforcement program update to the board in mid-July. On July 15th, the settlement agreement and stipulation for entry of administrative civil liability or ACL order with Stonebridge Properties LLC and Tigert Construction was signed and issued. The ACL was issued for construction stormwater violations associated with the Coldstream Planned Community Project in Truckee. This project encompassed 182 acres and is a large mixed-use development, including 10 acres of commercial use, 61 acres of residential use, and 109 acres of open space and recreational use. It also included a recreational trail along Coldstream Creek. The project is located south of Highway 80 and Donner Pass Road off-ramp, and stormwater from the site flows to Coldstream Creek, a tributary to Truckee River. To settle the alleged violations, the Lahontan Water Board's prosecution team, Stonebridge Properties, and Tigert Construction have agreed to the imposition of an ACL of $917,199. Of this amount, $472,199 was paid to the State Water Pollution Cleanup and Abatement Account. The remaining $445,000 will be permanently suspended upon completion of the Donner Creek Restoration Supplemental Environmental Project. That project includes three sites need restoration along Donner Creek and is expected to be completed within...
Shelby, if you can hear me, your mic isn't working or your audio.
If I can get that fixed.
Oh, now we can hear you.
Oh, interesting. Were you guys
in the room because we heard her on the Zoom platform? Oh.
What portion did you not hear, and what would you like me to repeat?
Like 30 seconds ago.
Okay. I'll summarize that last one. since I don't know where
you just mentioned this. You mentioned the SEP, the Donner Creek SEP, and then it cut out after that.
So that Donner Creek SEP is for restoration along three sites on Donner Creek. And they're working with another local agency, and they will be expected to be completing that SEP probably within this year. The second ACL that was completed on August 13th, an ACL with Caltrans and North Tahoe Public Utility District, or NTPUD, was signed and issued. This ACL was issued in response to a raw sewage spill in July 2020.
Shelby, we can't hear you again. AGP, is it an issue in our... Shelby, you probably couldn't hear that, but it might be an issue in this room rather than your mic, but we're not positive.
This last one, TJ Middle Miss Clark was the division manager that oversaw this one. I can send him, because I actually summarized it for my notes. I can send it to him and he can explain it at the podium, or I can send it to Ben.
I've got a copy of a enforcement press release here, so I can cover it.
Okay.
So as Shelby was saying, this was a settlement that was reached for $85,000, or sorry, $850,000. 85,000 gallons of untreated sewage was released to Lake Tahoe on July 18th, 2024. There's a supplemental environmental project for this project. These improvements will be a public restroom and drinking fountain facilities at Sea Klein Beach to improve and manage the safe disposal of wastewater. These improvements will further the human right to sanitation and safe drinking water in Kings Beach, an economically disadvantaged community. Just want to add that this was a great response by our staff to that spill. Many may recall in the news that when this occurred in July 2024, great job by Kristen Tokheim. She works in Trevor Miller's unit, and ultimately it resulted in a good outcome in terms of an environmental project. So we're pretty proud about the work. And hats goes off to Shelby as well for her work on the enforcement side. Okay, the next thing I'd like to cover is the board schedule. So you should have received some hard copies, board members, this morning. And what that is a draft of the schedule for the 2026 board meetings. Of note, we added a seventh meeting, so we've got meetings proposed in February, March, May, June, August, September, and November. So we added a seventh meeting, which we can we don't have to utilize that time when we get there. In other words, maybe a meeting that we throw out at some point, but maybe that'll provide some more flexibility for the board and staff. So what I ask here is that you take a look at it, look at your own schedule, and provide Ariel any feedback on those dates and locations by September 12th, which is 2 weeks from tomorrow. Next, I'd like to go to the slides that were up previously, AGP. Okay, so the next three slides are just some photographs of the Tahoe Summit, which took place earlier in August. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend, but we had a booth there with Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, and many staff also attended. The booth showcased information on our harmful algal bloom program and had a lot of information about Lake Tahoe TMDL program as well. The theme of the summit this year was protecting Lake Tahoe, balancing sustainable recreation. So you can see our staff there in the photo interacting with other agency folks and answering questions from the public. Next slide. Lieutenant, I'm going to not get this name pronunciation right, so if anybody has a correction, but Lieutenant Governor Elnay Kounalakis was in attendance. Did I get it right?
Kounalakis.
Sorry. And also U.S. Governor Adam Schiff, who I understand was the M.
Senator.
Right. I knew that. Adam Schiff was in attendance. Next slide. Just a couple of the brochures that were there. Again, the theme was balancing sustainable recreation. Jeremy Renner, the actor, Hawkeye, like my kids tell me, I guess is a superhero. He plays that superhero in as far as acting career, but he was also a speaker at the event. And incidentally, he pointed out to the audience and that there was a sewage issue along Camp Richardson Beach, which our staff were responding to actually in real time during the summit. But overall, as I understand, it was a great summit. Really appreciate the staff that were able to represent us there with the booth. Always a pleasure to share that booth with NDEP. And Mary Fiore Wagner, who's in the audience, I'd like her to come up and add anything. She helped coordinate our attendance.
Thanks, Ben. Good afternoon. Acting Chair Pierce, thanks for stepping in. Board members Mary, and the public, Mary Fiore Wagner, Environmental Program Manager with the Compliance and Planning Division. Want to take credit. That was my mistake on Governor, a.k.a. Senator Schiff. Sorry about that. Yeah, it was great to be part of this. It's a great bipartisan showcase of bipartisan and also cross-boundary between California and Nevada, the partnerships. It was a huge celebration of the reauthorization of the LTRA funding, Lake Tahoe Restoration Act funding. Dennis Sabaglo earlier touched on that. Real significant amount of funding that we get for the basin goes towards critical environmental restoration projects, transportation improvement projects, and also aquatic invasive species control projects. So that was nice that we had that reauthorization. Ben touched on the harmful algal blooms. That's always of big interest to folks. It was a nice networking for Lori Scribe, especially. She's the new non-point source supervisor. She hadn't met a lot of the partners and the agencies that we work with. And we also had some discussions about the Lake Tahoe Dam rehabilitation project, which we've permitted two investigations that were going on, some core sampling that they've done, as well as some geotechnical studies to look at the viability, the integrity of the existing structure. And, you know, that project will come to us in the future if it's going to be a full rebuild or they will be able to work with some of the material in place. So was happy to be part of that again. We have the little program if anybody's interested. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. And then one final thing, and then we can get to any additional questions or comments the board may have. But I just wanted to mention that the board of the chairs meeting with State Water Board is on October 3rd, and Rob and I plan on attending that. And with that, that concludes my report.
Ready for questions, Jeff?
Just a really quick one. On scheduling, we have a meeting November 5 and 6 coming up, 2025. Do we have a location for that nailed down? At one point it was Barstow, and now it's TBD. And do we know where we're going to be on the 5th and 6th?
Yeah, great question, Jeff. We are discussing internally, probably know within the week or 2 weeks at the most about the exact location. There's some things that we need to take into consideration, given some of the items and availability of board members and other things. But we'll know again by first or second week of September.
Rick?
No questions.
Amy?
Yeah, first a comment. For many years, I used to go to the Lake Tahoe Summit, and for various reasons, lately, I've only been able to log in and stream it online. But I want board members to know that the real benefit of the summit is an opportunity to network, for us to network with the other agencies, people you've met who've made presentations here, and then talk to people who have booths that we never see, like people from the Nevada Department of Fish and Wildlife, who told me for the first time that the Asian clams, in an invasive species that was introduced to Lake Tahoe, now infects the Truckee River all the way down into Nevada. So that was interesting news. Anyway, if you're able to attend that summit personally, I highly encourage you to do so. I had a quick conversation with the director of TRPA when she was here earlier this morning, and suggested that they might want to put all of us on the invitation list in the future, and she said she would take care of that. So fingers crossed we all hear about it in time to sign up next year. And then I just had one question about the EO item items that is at the end of your report, bait stamp 617, 618. The documents specifically, there are a whole number of, there are several 401 certifications that were listed here, and at a previous WQCC, we got a report from the Office of Chief Counsel about the implications of the Sackett decision and how it was going to increase the workload of the regional water board staff in dredge and fill permitting and things like that, because no longer having the support of the Army Corps of Engineers. So I just wanted to hear an update about those documents, what your experience has been so far, and the implications of Sackett.
So I don't know offhand if there's been a downtrend in the number of 401 certifications issued, because the 401 certifies the Army Corps 404 permitting at a federal level. So sometimes Army Corps doesn't find something jurisdictional, then we don't issue the associated 401. But we have, just sort of anecdotally, based on what I've seen come through my queue, we are utilizing a WDR we have to be able to address any water quality concerns for waters of the state. We have issued several notices of applicability on multiple projects associated with that permit. So we still maintain our authority and ability to address water quality concerns for work that that are within waters of the state, not necessarily waters of the U.S. Does that help? Oh, something to add? Okay.
Hello again, Mary Fiore Wagner. I can just add, great question, Amy. We did an exercise, actually, to go back and see how our workload has increased because of this, where we're not issuing the 401s. We are issuing WDRs for waters of the state. And it's about 25 that came through for annually last year. And Brian Talmadge, if that is not accurate and you're online, if you want to correct that. But it was an exercise that we recently did.
So it's 25 more or less, or, I mean, what's the impact on your workload? substantively for work in those areas.
So rather than go under the existing, they were individually these WDRs, so created a bit more workload for staff.
And there is a position that we, as part of, associated with the Sackett decision, that's still in limbo a little bit. It was one of the positions that was identified in the budget reduction from earlier in the year. And so there's a little bit of uncertainty whether or not that actually will come back for us and be available. But that should help address any additional workload after that decision.
Thank you, Ben. I have no questions. I appreciate all the information.
Yep.
So with that, the board will not be entering into a closed session today. Later today, less than a quorum of the board, staff, and public will be performing a field tour of the Tahoe Keys. Participants should meet at 2 p.m. here at the Lahontan Water Board Annex, South Lake Tahoe. Thank you, everyone, for your participation today. The regular meeting of the board is adjourned. Thank you.